For those of you that may be our guests this morning, we're in a series of conversations in which we're thinking together, quite honestly, about what we should be doing as the people of God between now and when Jesus comes back, or to put it in the terms that we've been using, between now and until the whole world hears. We're in the middle of our missions emphasis month. And in fact, we're moving very rapidly toward our missions conference, if I may call it that, our global impact celebration that happens on October 3rd through the 7th. And again, I would just remind you, if you don't have that on your calendar by now, shame on you, but go home and put it on your calendar. And for that month, and in this month prior to that, where we've been talking a great deal about what God is asking us to do, and we've narrowed it down to four things that we believe are critical that God anticipates and expects us to do until the whole world hears. And those four things are that we are to pray, we are to serve, we are to give, and we are to tell. And we've talked about pray and serve, and quite obviously this morning, by virtue of the video and by virtue of just the order of things, this morning we're going to talk about giving until the whole world hears. Now, before we begin this conversation this morning, I have a question that I would just be interested in knowing. How many of you in this room have been believers for 5 years or more? All right, that's the vast majority of you. Now, the reason I ask that question is really quite simple. It is because missions is most frequently done by mature Christians. Now, please don't misunderstand me. That certainly doesn't mean that younger Christians can't participate in and contribute to missions. They can. I mean, that would just be wrong. But the driving force behind missions is most frequently by those who are mature. Now, there's a very simple reason for that, and that's because missions require sacrifice, and sacrifice demands maturity. You rarely see immature people doing sacrificial things. And so if we're going to sacrifice, and mission demands sacrifice, it means giving up some things. It means being able to and willing to set priorities that may be uncomfortable. It requires us to sacrifice, and if we're going to sacrifice, then sacrifice simply demands maturity. And so the obvious question is, how do you measure maturity? And we talked about this briefly last week together, because the truth of the matter is this. All 4 weeks of this series, we're dealing with the same issue. And that same issue just appears in different places of our life and different forms. And it's all about whether or not we're going to give ourselves to God and do the things that He asks us to do, because He is concerned with us reaching the whole world. And we said last week that there were three things that had to be true of us, that as followers of Jesus, who were going to do what we are to do until the whole world hears, it's going to require us to grow and be mature in three areas of our life. First of all, in a biblical worldview, we need to understand how the Scripture talks about life and how we understand life from a scriptural perspective. And secondly, we need an eternal perspective. We need to be able to see life in the context of eternity. And then thirdly, we need a servant's heart. Now, last week we talked about a servant's heart. We spent almost the entire Sunday talking about that. And today I want to talk a great deal about an eternal perspective. Now, what is an eternal perspective? Well, an eternal perspective is seeing life through an eternal lens so that you can make life's decisions and manage life's resources in light of eternity. I mean, after all, if our life is to be understood in the context of eternity, then the decisions we make and the way we use our resources in the here and now has something to say about our eternity, and eternity has something to say about how we do those things. So today we're going to talk about giving and generosity, and understand something. Generosity flows out of two very closely related ideas. Generosity is related to our love for the mission, fueled by an eternal perspective. Can I ask you some questions this morning? I mean, I always talk about having a conversation with you, and I would love to do that on one hand, and on the other hand, it scares the daylights out of me because I have no idea what you'd say. Hello. Anybody listening? Just checking. Let me see if we're on the same page this morning. Can I do that? Do you believe with all of your heart that Jesus Christ is the only way to God? I mean, do you believe it? Okay. Do you believe that if people go through life, can be even nice people, live what appears to be a good life, but they never embrace Jesus Christ by faith, that they will be eternally separated from Him? Do you believe that? A little weaker there. You believe it? All right. Do you also believe that God, in His great mercy, has made it possible for people to come to Him through Christ? Oh man, that's our message, isn't it? I mean, that's what we're all about. Do you believe that if people never hear the story of Jesus, they can never believe that story, and if they never believe that story, they can never be saved? Do you believe that? Do you believe that? Come on, stay with me. If so, then, doesn't that make telling the story of Jesus to people who don't know it the highest priority of our life? Do you believe that too? Do you love the mission that God has given us? I mean, do you love it? Can we supercharge that for a moment? Do you believe that the decisions that we make in the here and now have eternal consequences? Yeah? Do you believe that when people enter eternity, their chance at trusting Christ and receiving Him is over? That is final, that there is no other opportunity? And do you believe then that it is critical that everyone hears the story and gets at least the chance to say yes to Christ? And if you believe that, what would you be willing to do to make that happen? What would you be willing to give up to make that happen? What would you be willing to sacrifice to make sure that every person on this planet gets an opportunity to hear the story of Jesus? In fact, put it that way, do you have anything or need anything that is worth more than that? Really? See, generosity requires two very closely related ideas: a love for missions fueled by an eternal perspective. Listen, folks, this is a relatively small church, and a fairly quiet one too, might I add. But we're a fairly small church that's engaging in God's mission at a whole new level. And I don't know about you, but I find that very exciting. Everywhere I go and I get a chance to talk about what you folks are doing in missions, people are amazed at what we've been able to do with a church the size that we are. Churches much larger than ours aren't doing nearly as much in terms of missions as this church is doing. And I couldn't be more proud of you. I mean, it excites the daylights out of me that we're able to do that. I was talking with my daughter Heather this week about this message. And she reminded me of a conversation that I used to have. It's probably because it's indelibly imprinted in her mind. We had it so often. But she reminded me of a conversation that I used to have with my girls all the time. And we would talk about school and the importance of school. And I can remember I would say to them, I really don't care what grades you get, as long as you do your very best. If you do your best and get a D, I'm okay. If you get an A and you don't do your best, I'm still not okay. Because doing everything that you can do is far more important to me than some letter grade or some marker that you get out there. But somewhere in there, I would always slip in this line. But I know what you're capable of, and I have high expectations for you. That is exactly how I feel about this church. We're doing some great stuff here. Thank you. And there's a whole lot more on the horizon. But I know what you're capable of. I know that we're capable of doing much more. We've just begun to scratch the surface. Our best is yet to come. But listen, folks, we will never maximize our potential. We will never do everything that God is calling us to do without it affecting our giving. And we can do something about that, can't we? I mean, that's one of those things that we control. We can do something about. So the question is, if we're going to talk about this, where should we start? And I think where I want to start is I want to start with just a very simple overview of biblical approach to giving. How does God want giving to work among His people? I mean, how did He set it up for this all to function? And I want to make three statements, and I'll explain them briefly. And I think in these three statements, we can give you an overview of how biblical giving is supposed to occur. Number one statement, the principle that governs all of biblical giving is stewardship. Now, that's the overarching principle. Now, a steward is simply someone, you know this, it's someone who manages somebody else's money. And according to the Bible, everything that we have ultimately belongs to whom? Belongs to God, doesn't it? I mean, He gave it to us, He provided it for us. By any number of means, ultimately everything that we have, everything that we are, belongs to Him. That means that we get to enjoy the benefit of possessing and using some of His resources. But they're not ultimately not ours. All the while that we're using them, it kind of feels like they're ours, doesn't it? And if that goes on long enough without us reminding ourselves that they're not, we start to think that they are. But ultimately, they're not our resources. They are His resources. And as we use them and manage them, we should use them in a way that He would approve of. And ultimately, there will be an accountability. God will ask us, what did you do with what I gave you, with the resources that I gave you? So the first principle in here, the overarching principle, is that of stewardship. Now, the second statement is that out of that stewardship where you're managing God's resources, God asks for the first 10% always. I mean, that's just a carte blanche thing with Him. He says, I want the first 10%. In spiritual terms, that's called tithing. And the purpose of the tithe is not necessarily what you think it is. I mean, most of you think that, well, 10%, I just got to give that. That's my tax to the church. You know what the first 10% given to God's really all about? It is to acknowledge His ownership over everything and to affirm your gratitude and submission to Him as the owner. That's what that's about. In fact, in Leviticus 27:30, it makes this statement. It says, one-tenth of the produce of the land, whether grain from the fields or fruit from the trees, belongs to the Lord and must be set apart to Him as holy. I mean, even in the agrarian society in which they lived, they found a way to do what God asked them to do. And that was to give a tenth of everything that they grew. Why did they do that? Because He has ownership over it. It's His. It belongs to Him, it says. So that's so much true, in fact, that He goes on to tell us that when we use it for some other purpose, that we're stealing from Him. Now, I understand something. The purpose of the tithe is ultimately to acknowledge his ownership. He uses it to fund the ministries and the ministers among God's people. And he says, if you use it for some other reason than that, you're actually taking my money. You're stealing from me. In Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, it says, you cheated me of the tithes and the offerings due to me. You're under a curse, for your whole nation has been cheating me. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, so there will be enough food in my temple. Now notice, it doesn't say, you know, you schlocks haven't been doing anything. It doesn't say that. But it says, you've been taking some of what should have been mine, and you've been using it for other purposes. And therefore, he says, you have been cheating me, and because you're cheating me, you're under a curse. Now, don't misunderstand that term. I mean, we're not talking voodoo here. What are we talking about? We're talking about God looking at his people saying, you're using my money for your purposes, therefore, I'm going to work against you. It's not only a matter that I'm not going to work for you, I'm not going to remain neutral on this, I am going to work against you. And things aren't going to go as well as you would like them to go. He says, now, if you'll get it right, and if you'll begin doing what you're supposed to do, then he says, I'll begin working for you again, and there'll be no pests, and there'll be no insects, and your crops will get stronger and bigger, and they'll grow. I'll begin to work for you again. You know, some people say that tithing is legalistic. I hear that all the time. You know, I don't believe in tithing because it's legalistic. Are you telling me that anytime God tells us to do something, that's legalism? The definition of legalism is very simple. Legalism is requiring something of people that God doesn't require of us. But in clear terms, he says, this is what I want from you. See, tithing is no more legalism than loving your neighbor is legalism. God commanded us to do both of them. You say, but God didn't tell us how much we're supposed to love our neighbor. Yeah, he did. As I have loved you. Remember that line? See, God not only sets a standard in terms of our behavior, he often tells us how to measure it. And that's precisely what he's doing here. See, God asked for the first 10%, and then he looks at us, he says, now listen, you get to manage the next 90% for me. I mean, don't forget, all the while you're managing it and using it, you're doing it for me. But you get to manage that 90%. Now, there's a third statement in here. God may ask for more from you than that 10%. In fact, let me restate that. I think there's a very good chance that somewhere along the way in your life, God's going to say, listen, I want more than that out of you. You're capable of more than that. Those are called free will offerings. I know what some of you are thinking. You're thinking, well, if they're free will, that means I can choose whether or not I participate. Yes and no. You know, I think we need to be clear about that. Let me try to explain. What it really means is that free will offerings are not universally mandated. The tithe is. I mean, it just says to all of us, that's what I expect from you. And so to that degree, they are free will. Now, if anything is free will, I mean, if you have free will, what does that mean? Well, it means that you can say yes or you can say no, right? I mean, you can exercise your will to say yes or you can exercise your will to say no. You're given the right of determination over that. Now, what if God asks you to do something and you exercise your free will to say no? What does that make you? A disobedient free will person. But it still makes us what? Disobedient, doesn't it? If God asks us to do something and we say no, or we try to negotiate with him. You know, I know God, you want this, but I'll do this instead. None of us have ever done that, right? But what does that make us? That makes us disobedient. See, you can say no, but should you? I mean, for those of us who are followers of Christ, shouldn't it be our great desire to be able to say yes to Him anytime and every time He asks us to do something? Do we really feel like, in terms of following Christ, that we should ever feel at liberty to exercise our ability to say no to Him? So what is the key to deciding how you should respond to a free will offering? Well, the key is to make sure that you know that God's asking. And if you're sure that God's asking you to do it, then what should the automatic answer be? The automatic answer should be yes. Because if He's asking you to participate, then we know what our answer should be. If in the life of this church or any church, you're given opportunity to participate in a free will offering, and I'll guarantee you at some point you will be, then the right thing to do is what? It's to pray about it, to ask God how much, but agree up front, whatever He asks you to do, the answer is yes. Before He ever speaks the amount, agree that the answer is yes if He's the one asking. See, every time God asks you for something, it's a test of three things. Maybe it's more than that, but at least three things. Every time God asks you to do something, whether it's to give, to be, to act, anytime God asks you to do something, it's a test of three things. Number one, it's a test of love. It's always a test of love. Do you love Him the way He loves you? If God asks you to go out today and to give the largest gift you've ever given, what's He doing? He's asking you a very simple question. Do you love Me as much as I have loved you? That question is present in everything that He asks you to do. And do you love what He loves? Because there is no loving without giving. There's a second thing that He's testing. He's testing your faith. Do you trust God to provide what you need if you give Him what He asked for? I mean, if God asks you to give something, don't you think He knows where you're at in life? And will you trust Him to give you what you need if you give Him what He asked for? Can we be really clear about something here? Ultimately, God doesn't need anything from you. So, huh? He doesn't. God is wholly capable of finding a way to accomplish and achieve anything and everything that He wants to achieve. Listen, if He can create the universe by fiat, He can figure out how to solve a financial problem in federal way. His desire is to use us to do some of those things. He chooses to work through you. So it has all of the appearances that He needs something from you, doesn't it? Because He often says, this is the way I'm going to do this. Do you realize that if you won't do what God asks you to do, it's not going to change His ability to get something done that He needs to get done. He'll just find somebody else who will do it and use them and give them the blessing. That's always the way He works. In reality, everything He asks you to do is not because of His need, it is for your good. Understand that principle, that's critical. Every time God asks you to do something, it is not because of His need, it is for your good. Do you trust Him? Because every time He asks you to do something, it is a test of faith. Thirdly, it's a test of obedience. It's a test of obedience. Do you honor His sovereignty over all of life and respect His authority over your life? And do you do so sufficiently that you will say yes to Him no matter what He asks? Do you honor His sovereignty over all of life and respect His sovereignty and His authority over your life sufficiently that you'll say yes to him no matter what. Now, again, I know that what some of you are thinking. You're thinking, well, if that's the definition of free will, then tithing is free will. Because after all, I choose whether or not I do that. And I'll just point out to you, the vast majority of Christians choose not to. Truth be told, and you know this, the Bible says up front, the first 10% is mine. If you use your free will to say no, you're not only disobedient, but you're stealing from him. Worse than that, he says, I'll not only withhold the blessing, I'll work against you. For you business-minded people, here's how I think about this. Tithing is a fixed cost. Free will offering is a discretionary cost. But understand something. Anytime God asks, there's always a cost to it. Because he's proving something. And he's proving it not to himself, but he's proving it to you. He's proving that you love him. He's proving that you trust him. He's proving that you're willing to obey him. You know, there's a great illustration of a free will offering in the New Testament. It's a collection that was taken up, and in fact, you find statements about it through many of the epistles. And the story goes a little bit like this. The church in Jerusalem, because of economic conditions and because of persecution, was struggling enormously. I mean, some of those Jerusalem Christians and that church in general was living in unbelievable levels of poverty. And the Apostle Paul, in his travels, took it upon himself, I say took it upon himself, I'm assuming, led by God, to ask the churches that he was traveling among to consider taking up an offering for this church back in Jerusalem. Now, I'm bringing this up because I think this is a model of how free will giving ought to be done. And what he does is he goes from place to place and he asks them if they're willing. In fact, in the church at Corinth, he went to the church in Corinth and he asked them if they would be willing to give. They got all excited about it. And they said, well, of course we will. And he said, all right, when I come back through, I'm going to go up here and I'm going to travel. And when I come back through, you have the money collected by that point, and I'll take it with me and I'll deliver it to Jerusalem. And so he went on his way and he went up into some of the churches in Macedonia and he asked them if they would be willing to give. Now, I'm just telling you, some of those churches were almost as poor as the ones back in Jerusalem. And yet those churches, the Bible tells us, gave to this cause not out of their abundance but out of their poverty. And in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Corinth and he did two things. He first of all commended those Macedonian Christians for their incredible generosity. And he gave us a glimpse into their heart. And as a result of giving us a glimpse into their heart, he gave us a picture of what God actually wants from all of us. And then he gave some instructions to the church in Corinth. And I want you to this morning to see, and I'm going to go through these really quickly, but I want you to see seven principles that come out of those two chapters that affect giving. Now, keep in mind, we're not talking about how to fund the local church. That's not on the horizon here. This is how do you collect an offering for something that the church needs to do above and beyond its normal responsibilities? How do you do that? Let me give you these. Number one, one's ability to give is not dependent upon the size of your bank account, but on the size of your heart. That one's hard to grasp, isn't it? But listen to what it says in verse 3 of 2 Corinthians chapter 8. For I can testify that they gave not only what they could afford, but far more. And they did it of their own free will. They begged us again and again for the privilege of sharing in the gift for these believers. The believers in Macedonia were extremely poor. They were not only poor, they were experiencing persecution. They couldn't give out of their excess. They didn't have any. The only way that they could give anything would be out of their poverty. And yet they continued to give. Listen, folks, your ability to give is not determined by how much money you have. If you are faithful, even sacrificial, with what you have, what will God do? He'll give you more, won't he? I mean, isn't that the fundamental principle of stewardship? If you use well what God's given you, then he's going to give you more. Excuse me. And that's ultimately how we can give beyond our capability, isn't it? Is when we take what God gives and then reinvest that again as he gives us more. Principle number two. How eager we are to give proves how much we love. How eager we are to give. Do you get excited to give? Think about it. Because it really is a measure of your love. In verse 8 of that same chapter, it says, I'm not commanding you to do this. Paul says, I'm not telling you got to do it. Instead, I'm testing how genuine your love is by comparing it to the eagerness of other churches. He said, I look around and I see how some churches are so eager and it speaks so clearly about their love for the cause and for their eternal perspective. And listen, folks, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is selfishness. You've heard the old adage, you can give without loving, but you can't love without giving. It's true. It's true. For God so loved the world that he did what? That he gave. See, giving and loving are virtually synonymous terms. In fact, the very next verse of this chapter tells us that we know how full of love the Lord was. Now, how do we know how full of love he was? Because though he was rich, yet he became poor, so that through his poverty he could make us rich. I mean, that's the measure of his love. And so Paul says, in asking you to give, I'm actually testing your love. We've already talked about that. But he goes on to say, here's my advice. It would be good for you to finish what you started a year ago. Last year you were the first who wanted to give, and you were the first to begin doing it. Now you should finish what you started. In other words, folks, your love is not measured by the size of the commitment you make. It's actually measured by the size of the gift that you give. You say, well, there shouldn't be a difference between us. You're right, there shouldn't. But there often is, isn't there? And that was the issue in this church. You know, a year ago they said, oh, we want to do this. And now Paul's reminding them. He says, listen, you need to finish what you started. You need to keep the commitments that you've made. Principle number three, our giving to God should be proportionate to his provision to us. He says in verse 11, give in proportion to what you have. Whatever you give is acceptable if you give it eagerly. And give according to what you have, not what you don't have. In other words, the cycle that runs here comes with us giving and then God rewarding that by giving us more, and then we reinvest that. That's how we're able to do more. Do you realize on a percentage basis, the poor in this country give more to charitable causes than the upper middle class and the wealthy? It's true. That's not the way it should work in the church. He says, give in proportion to what you have. Now, I want to be careful here, but I want to say this nonetheless. The amount of your gift is not important. as long as it's given with the right heart, as long as it's given eagerly, he says. See, people who are eager to give tend to exceed all expectations, don't they? But people who don't want to give won't give no matter how much they have. It really is ultimately a hard issue. And he says, don't try to give what you don't have. Just eagerly give what you do, and God will provide you with more to give. Principle number four, our giving should be willing and cheerful, not grudging and pressured. He said, verse 5 of chapter 9, but I don't want it. Or he says, I want it to be a willing gift, not one that's grudging. If everything we've said so far is true, then all giving should ultimately be willing, shouldn't it? My task today is not to pressure you into giving anything. It is to present the Word of God to you so clearly that you can decide whether or not you are willing to give. And if you're willing to give, then do so cheerfully, he says. Verse 7 of that same chapter, you must each decide in your heart how much to give. And don't give reluctantly or in response to pressure. For God loves a person who gives cheerfully. We've already said this, but giving is not because of God's need. It's because of your need. You need to give. We should be excited to do so. Principle number 5. God's giving to us is often proportionate to our giving to Him. Now, you said, wait a minute, I thought you said my giving was to be proportionate to what He gives me. It is. And in response, His giving back to you is going to be proportionate to your giving to Him. In verse 6 of chapter 9, it says, remember this, a farmer who plants only a few seeds will get a small crop. But the one who plants generously will get a generous crop. You know, this law is so fundamental to how God works. What you harvest is always in direct proportion to what you sow. You give a little, you get a little. You give a lot, you get a lot. Now, I don't mean a lot in terms of dollar amount. I mean in terms of what God has given you. This is a proportionate kind of idea. You say, well, Don, I'm concerned about that kind of teaching. It can lead to trying to manipulate God. You know what? I'm concerned about it too. But the one place where I might disagree with you, I've never been terribly successful in manipulating God. That's never worked very well for me. But the same concern is there. That's why the next principle is so significant. We give so we can receive, so we can give again. You miss that principle, and you're going to miss something very significant. You're going to imagine, well, if I give a lot, I can get a lot, and I can go spend it, and boy, that was a good investment. That's not His intention. You do that, that's one generation giving. It's over. But here's the deal. If you will give, and give generously, then He will give you more, and if you give that, if you reinvest that, then you begin to build literally a lifestyle of generosity. Verse 8 says, and God will generously provide all you need, then you will always have everything you need and plenty left over to share with others. That's the principle. You give, God will make sure that you get what you need as well as have enough to give. And when you do that, you begin releasing money into His work. And see, God wants to promote that lifestyle of generosity. Verse 10, for God is the one who provides seed for the farmer and then bread to eat. In the same way, He will provide and increase your resources and then produce a great harvest of generosity to you. Now, why are we talking about this? What difference does all this make? Because this morning I want to invite you to participate in a faith commitment offering. I want to give you an opportunity to participate in an offering that really functions much like we've just seen here, in which we ask the question, What are you willing to do? And you go and you pray about it and you ask God, what should I do? And he comes back and says, this is what I want out of you. And listen to me carefully. Whatever he says to you is fine. It's his work. It's his resources. And you're his child. And whatever he says to you is fine. All we're going to do is encourage you to do exactly what he says. See, we feel like God is calling us to do more in missions than we have provision to do. And we want to release more money into the harvest. And we want to do it in a way that gains God's blessing and promotes a lifestyle of generosity. And so we're simply going to try to apply the principles that we've seen in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9 and throughout other places in the Scripture and apply them to world missions right here at Lifeway Church. And so I want to invite you today to begin immediately asking God and seeking Him for what He would have you to do. Now, we've prepared a brochure that I would like for you to have, and I'm going to ask the ushers just very quickly to put one of those in your hands. I want everyone to have one. I don't want you to sit and read them throughout the rest of my conversation with you this morning. But you ask the question, what is a faith commitment offering? Well, it's exactly what it says. First of all, it is an act of faith. It is us looking at our resources, asking God, and trusting Him by faith that He will tell you what He wants you to do and that He will provide for you after you say yes and do what He asks you to do. Now, don't reverse those, but believe that He's going to tell you what He wants you to do, and when you say yes and you do what He says you're going to do, trust Him that He's going to give you what you need. Secondly, it is a commitment to God. It is to say to Him, this is what I hear your voice speaking to me. This is what you're placing on my heart. This is what I believe that I want or that you want me to do. And whatever it is, I'm making that commitment and I'm making it to you. And thirdly, it's a free will offering. It's a free will offering. It's everything that we have described. It's an opportunity to do something above and beyond your normal giving. Now, I guess I got to say this. Typically, what has happened in this church and in a lot of churches across America is when we take a special gift, people just move it from one pocket to the other. You know what I mean? Say, well, yeah, I want to give to missions, and so I'll reduce what I give over here so I can give a little more here. No, don't do that. Don't do that. I mean, honestly, if that's what you have, then don't participate. We would much rather that you continue to do. And honestly, one of the reasons why this is so important to us is because in our normal giving in this church, it doesn't provide enough that we're able to do everything that God is calling us to do. And so we believe that God always provides through His people. And I believe that all of the resources we need is already in our congregation. We just have to release them and unleash them so that God can use them. Now, how does this faith commitment offering work? Well, there are five steps. Those five steps are very simple. First of all, commit to God in advance that you will give whatever He asks you to give. I mean, when you start this process of thinking and praying and asking God, tell Him up front, Lord, whatever you say to me, whatever you tell me to do, I will do it. Because you know He's not going to ask for more than He provides. And so it's that test of faith again. But you got to tell Him, I'll give what you ask me to give. Second step, then pray and ask God, what is that? What is it you want me to give? How much is that amount? You know, I understand the amount, the percentage. The amount to us isn't nearly as critical as what goes on in our life and in our heart. But God's going to ask you to do something. Whatever it is, do it. Number three, listen carefully to what He speaks into your heart and mind. And when He says it, don't say, ooh, boy, You just exceeded my limits. Listen carefully. And don't push back when He speaks into your heart. Folks, I'm just telling you, he'll tell you what he wants you to do. Fourthly, then record the amount on that commitment card that is inside of that brochure that we gave you. And bring it with you to the celebration service of our Global Impact Celebration on October 7th. Bring it with you. We want to collect all of the cards at that point, as many as possible. Now, if it takes you longer than that and you're still not clear, keep praying. No one's going to pressure you. Just keep praying and ask God to tell you what to do. And number five, then begin giving as you have committed and as God has prospered. That's as difficult as this process gets. Commit to do it. Pray and ask Him what to do. Listen carefully when He answers. Record it and make the commitment. And then number five, do what He asks you to do. Listen, if we do that, if every person in this church does that, I'm good. Now I got one more thing I want to say to you. I told you going into it in 2 Corinthians chapter 7 or 8 and 9, there were seven principles. I only gave you six. There's one more. That one more principle is, in my opinion, it is the key to this kind of generous giving. There's something that has to happen to make that possible. And it's not economic. It's not income. It's something inside of you. All true giving begins with giving of yourself first. Always. In chapter 8, verse 5, it says, they did even more than we had hoped, for their first action was to give themselves to God and to us, just as God wanted them to do. He said, listen, they were able to do beyond what anyone would have anticipated. Not because of our great appeal to them, not because we reached down into their heart and jerked it around until finally we wrenched the last dollar out of them, but because they had, before they did anything, given themselves to God first. As an individual, as a church, we will never give beyond the limits of our own finite resources until we give ourselves to God first. What does that mean? What does it mean to give yourself to God first, before anything else? I did a bit of thinking about this. Can I show you how I think of this? If this doesn't relate to you, if it doesn't make sense to you, that wouldn't terribly surprise me. But this is how I think of this. We kind of set the parameters for our own life, don't we? I mean, we kind of define life for ourselves. And we say, you know, I'm going to put boundaries and parameters around my life, and what's inside of that, that's me. And after I've defined it all, then I'm willing to say to God, here's my life. Let me show you what I mean. For some of us, what we do kind of defines who we are, don't we? You know, I mean, all you have to do is listen to people talk about themselves, and one of the first things is, well, I'm a teacher. I'm a lawyer. You know, I'm a whatever. And we say that in part because it just provides some identification, but in part that's because that's who we are. That's how we define ourselves. Some of us define ourselves not only by what we do, but by how much money we make. You know, and we like to say things in a way every once in a while that communicates to people, you know, I'm a high-income kind of guy. Or I'm a lady who's surpassing all the others in terms of income. You know, how much money I make, that helps define me. And it's not only how much money I make, but it's how much money I got. You know, I mean, I know lots of people who make a lot of money and are really poor, don't you? Because they just, I mean, that's just the way they live their life. That's what defines their life. Others, they make actually a very small amount, but they have a lot because that's the way they manage their life. That helps define their life. That helps to put those parameters in place as to what they are as people. You know, where I live defines my life. You know, not only the kind of house I live, but you know, the fact that I live in the most beautiful place in the world. You know, all that stuff kind of figures in. And, you know, and here I am. I'm this guy who does this, and I make this kind of money, and I got all this laid over here, and I'm living in this house in this beautiful place. I mean, boy, life's pretty good, isn't it? And then we look at, well, what possessions do I have, or what possessions do I want? And so I put my weakness up there, you know. The bigger, faster, shinier, yeah, that's mine. You know, but we look at, and that defines who we are as people. And then we look at, well, what do I like to do? You know, what's my leisure activity? Now, folks, these aren't just examples. There could be 100 things that you use to define who you are as an individual. The parameters that you set for your life, you know, those are the things, that's how you want to be thought of. When people hear your name, those are the things that you want them to think about. So what do? We naturally protect those things, don't we? You know, and we're not too quick to give those things away. And then our tendency is to go to God and say, here's my life. Don't you like it? I mean, wouldn't you like to use my life? Here's my life. Here's how I've defined it. And as long as it fits in my parameters, then here I am, Lord. Use me any way that you can. And sometimes we say that because we're not willing to step outside of those parameters that we've set for our own life. And sometimes we say it that way because we just dismiss all other possibilities. I mean, after all, if this is how I see my life, anything that would cause me to live outside of those parameters, I can just kind of dismiss it. I mean, it's not even something I consider. Because after all, those parameters are my life. Listen to me, folks. When you're in this mindset, God could call you to do something and you wouldn't even hear Him. I mean, we don't tend to hear those things that are outside of our perception of ourselves. And if someone suggests something that doesn't fit your perception, we just kind of dismiss it and say, you know, that must be a miscue. God must be talking to somebody else, and I just kind of got wired in to the wrong conversation here. And so we say, that's not me, because that's not how we defined our life. But can I ask you a question? Is that really giving yourself to God first? I mean, is that what the Scriptures have in mind? I think all of us know the answer to that already. Will you allow me to ask you a few more questions this morning? What if God came to you and said, I don't want you to live in the Puget Sound area. I don't want you to work at Boeing or Weyerhaeuser or World Vision or wherever else it is in this community that you may be working. But instead, I want you to go to Banjarmasin, Indonesia. I want you to live where there's spiders and snakes. And I want you to not be an executive manager, but I want you to teach English as a second language for the sole purpose of being able to connect with a group of people who have never heard the story of Jesus, so that after you build a relationship, you can have an opportunity to tell them that story. You okay with that? I mean, if that's what he asked you to do, you okay with that? Because I'm just telling you, if you do, that's gonna affect your parameters, isn't it? All of a sudden, there are some things that were awfully important to you that can't be now. Or what if God came to you and said, I don't want you to move to Baja Basin, but I want you to stay right where you are, doing the exact same job that you're doing, making the kind of money that you are, in fact, making more if you can, but what I want you to do is to live modestly, with as few possessions as possible, and release as much money into the kingdom work as you can possibly release. You okay with that? I mean, that'll define your life very differently, won't it? All of a sudden, there are some other things that are going to have to go away, and some other things that might make their entrance back into the definition of your life. Can we get really radical this morning? We can, just for the fun of it. What if instead of God coming to you, you went to God and you said, I have no parameters for my life. None. You define it. You tell me what you want. You make me the kind of person you can use, and then you use me however you see fit. And if you want me to make lots of money or a little, I'm okay with that. If you want me to live where there's spiders and snakes, I'm good. If you want me to live in modest surroundings with modest possessions, surrounded by people who you don't know and don't know you, I'm good with that. And if I need to forfeit my favorite leisure activity, there isn't a single one that I possess that can compare to the joy of being used by God. See, if you let God set the parameters for your life, if you intentionally open yourself up and say to Him, okay, Lord, you define my life. What are you most afraid of? Are you afraid that He'll shrink your life and steal all your joy? Or isn't it really that you're afraid that He'll expand your life and scare the daylights out of you? Do you know how you know when you've given yourself first and completely to God? It's when you say to Him, Lord, you set the parameters. I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll go wherever you want me to go. I will possess whatever you want me to possess. You say, Don, how do I get there? It's very simple. You know what the little word consecrate means? It means to take something that is ordinary and to set it apart for sacred use. The Scriptures talk about this in multiple times in multiple ways. And it's taking something very ordinary and putting it through whatever rites are necessary to set it apart so that it can be used for sacred things. Listen, that's exactly what God wants out of your life. He wants you to come to Him and say, listen, Lord, here is my everyday, ordinary life. Would you use it for your purposes? I am consecrating myself today. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to you. And listen to me carefully. When we do that, money's easy to come by. Father, thank you this morning. Help us to see your heart and your desire in here for us. Lord, I do pray this morning that you would take my life. Let it be exactly what you want it to be. You set the parameters. You determine the use. We ask it all through Christ. Amen.